right, the philosophical analysis of evolution. And obviously, the opening question just has to be, what does the philosopher have to say about the theory of evolution? After all, the theory of evolution has to do with the natural sciences. So what do you philosophers have to say about that? I think that's a natural question. And to begin tonight, I thought I'd very quickly remind you that philosophy used to include natural science. If you go all the way back to the opening days of Western philosophical development, you will notice that the Milesian philosophers, Thales, Anaximander, Anaximenes, were also interested in questions of natural science. And it was from those questions that they were led on to more basic questions about what underlies the unity of the universe and things like that. So Democritus, the earliest atomist that we're aware of, was a philosopher as well as a scientist. And of course, Aristotle, if you have the corpus of Aristotle's writings, you'll notice that that includes not only works on logic and metaphysics and ethics, but a good deal of his writing had to do with natural sciences. Francis Bacon, Pascal, Leibniz, we go on and on through the history of philosophy. Philosophers have often had a controlling interest in natural science as well. However, that's not usually the case today. Today, philosophers' job is usually accounted to be that of cross-examining opinions, especially those that have implications in a large number of places, implications for many areas of life, cross-examining argumentation that needs to be made honest. Socrates cross-examined the people of Athens in his day, finding out if they had good reasons for the things they believed, seeing if they were being consistent in the way they reasoned. And a philosopher, I think perhaps even more importantly, after doing his cross-examination work for clarity and consistency and good reasoning, must also bring together those things which are true, those things which have been found to be true in many areas of life, and putting them into a coherent whole, forming an overall world and life view, if you will. And since the subject of evolution is one which has been vigorously argued, one which has implications for many walks of life, and one which has to affect the development of an overall world and life view, it is fair game for philosophical analysis, or so I believe. In the course of the 19th century, the scientific approach to man's understanding of his own past came increasingly to dominate over the supernaturalism of traditional religious belief. Darwin's theory of evolution saw man as unmistakably part of the order and history of nature. Man is natural in his physical as well as his mental and moral characteristics. Of course, that's the devastating part of the theory. Although the issue of religion's compatibility with science antedated the evolution controversy, Darwin's theory elevated the issue to the level of a major international cultural concern. For good or for ill, 1859 became a significant turning point in the history of man's thought, especially in man's thought about himself and about his world. Whereas the diversity of man's world had been given interpretive order in the light of the supernatural creator revealed in the scriptures, and whereas the orderly and harmonious condition of things had been a major evidence of God's existence for natural theologians and Christian evidentialists, Darwinian evolution threatened to eradicate the notion of creative design from the explanation of nature, and thereby to pave the way for a full ascendancy of unadulterated naturalism in Western culture. And thus Charles Hodge, in his book entitled What is Darwinism, could find no other answer to his question than atheism. Charles Darwin had early in his life defected from the study of theology at Cambridge University. Instead, he said in his autobiography, he had in him a burning zeal to contribute to the noble structure of natural science. Darwin formulated his fundamental theory of evolution within 2 years of the end of the voyage, the famous voyage of the Beagle. And by that time, he had declared, in his own writings, that the doctrine of everlasting punishment was a damnable doctrine, and he had rejected the veracity of the gospel miracle accounts. At the time of writing The Origin of Species, Darwin was a rigorous opponent of any divine intervention in the course of nature. He called the doctrine of special creation, in fact, quote, a curious illustration of the blindness of preconceived opinion. And he banished any thought of divine control and direction, that is teleology, of historical development altogether. He said, no shadow of reason can be assigned for the belief that variations were intentionally and specially guided. At best, Darwin was a deist, which is, even at best, a full repudiation of God's natural and special revelation, I believe. But he later abandoned even that weak theological position for sheer agnosticism, saying, and I quote, the whole subject is beyond the scope of man's intellect. The mystery of the beginning of all things is insoluble by us. Thus admitting, it seems to me, that his rationalistic theory required an irrationalistic foundation. Interestingly, the man who formulated the theory of natural selection simultaneously with Darwin, Alfred R. Wallace, broke with Darwin and announced that natural selection does not apply to man or his mental powers, and that a spiritual essence came into action at the appearance of man, and thus holding to what is famously called theistic evolution. He said, quote, a superior intelligence has guided the development of man in a definite direction and for a special purpose. Darwin immediately, though quietly, decried this view as a failure of nerve, he said, and a disdainful hankering for miracles. Quite obviously, then, evolution as a theory has far-reaching religious implications and commitments. Its theological assumptions and effects just cannot be overlooked. Evolutionists have understood the doctrine of creation as implying the death of all autonomous science, and they affirm, and I quote one of them, it hardly needs saying that Darwinism is incompatible with any construction put upon either the Old or New Testament. Biblical creationism, you see, is being pitted against the evolutionary theory. Only a year after the publication of Darwin's Origin of Species, Dr. Asa Gray wrote, and I quote at length, the proposition that things and events in nature were not designed to be so, if logically carried out, is doubtless tantamount to atheism. If Mr. Darwin believes that the events which he supposes to have occurred and the results we behold were undirected and undesigned, or if the physicist believes that the natural forces to which he refers phenomena are uncaused and undirected, no argument is needed to show that such belief is atheistic. Asa Gray apparently said that, being a defender of theistic evolution, apparently said that not knowing about the quotes that I just gave you, where Darwin absolutely disdained Wallace for thinking that God directed this process. The Presbyterian theologian Robert L. Dabney made a similar observation, saying, if you persist in recognizing nothing but natural forces, it will land you, if you are consistent, nowhere short of absolute atheism. Because Darwinism attempts to obliterate or ignore the revelation of God, the Creator, in nature and in man, Charles Hodge said of it, the system is thoroughly atheistic, as much as that of Epicurus and Comte. By opposing the biblical account of creation and denying the evidences for creation in the world, evolutionism was properly understood, I think, to be contrary to Christian theism. Darwinism is a religious doctrine, since it teaches something about theology and about revelation, and it's a religious doctrine inclusive of certain biological speculations. It is in competition with the theological system that is taught in the scriptures. T.H. Huxley, the man known as Darwin's bulldog, was an avid follower of the unity of science thesis, materialistic determinism, and Spinoza's conception of God. Now, Huxley fully realized that by his endorsement of evolution, he had to take up arms against scriptural teaching. He had chosen certain assumptions and methods and proceeded upon a journey to explore the province of natural knowledge. And now I quote, yet I found that whatever route I took, before long I came to a tall, formidable-looking fence. Confident as I might be in the existence of an ancient and indefeasible right-of-way, before me stood the thorny barrier with the commendatory notice board, no thoroughfare by order of Moses. The only alternatives were to give up my journey, which I was not minded to do, or to break the fence down and go through it. End of quote. And so Huxley, preferring to stick to his autonomous presuppositions and aims, denounced the Mosaic teaching about the creation of the world by a transcendent personal God. You see, Huxley knew he had to find a way of eliminating the creationist teaching of Scripture if he was going to put all of this material about God and man out of mind, and the influence of God taken, and if he was going to remove the influence of God from natural science. And so Huxley admitted freely, and I quote again at length, we wanted not to pin our faith to that or any other speculation, but to get hold of clear and definite conceptions. the origin, meaning Darwin's Origin of Species, the origin provided us with the working hypothesis we sought. Moreover, it did us the immense service of freeing us forever from the dilemma, refuse to accept the creation hypothesis, and what have you to propose that can be accepted by a cautious reasoner. Oh, those are telling words. Huxley says, we were waiting for somebody to give us a way out. And Darwin, bless your soul, if there were a God to bless it, you gave it to us. Whether true or not, Darwin's theory revealed a way to avoid creationism. And so Huxley hailed the Origin of Species as, quote, a flash of light which, to a man who has lost himself in a dark night, suddenly reveals the road that, whether it takes him straight home or not, certainly goes his way. Robert Dabney concluded a century ago that Darwinism happens just now to be the current manifestation, which is the fashion of the day, which the fashion of the day gives to the permanent anti-theistic tendency in sinful men. By comparing evolution's advantages to creationism, said George Bernard Shaw, the world jumped at Darwin. And surely it did. However, the alleged victory of scientific naturalism over theological supernaturalism, which has been attributed by so many authors to Darwin's theory of evolution, bears philosophical scrutiny. Has the natural study of hard facts refuted the theological dogmas of the Bible? I shall argue that it has not done so by any means or stretch of the imagination. Yet I shall do so not by marshaling the impressive scientific evidence we possess for refuting evolutionary claims. And I do want to make sure you hear that before I get into my philosophy. There is impressive scientific problems with the theory of evolution that the evolutionists today are doing nothing better but politically trying to suppress. Impressive things that can be said against it. But I'm not going to talk about that tonight. That's not my sphere of competence anyway. You didn't come here tonight to hear somebody do that. I'm going to do it rather by analyzing the nature of the theory of evolution, showing that it has nothing to do with the natural study of hard facts whatsoever. Notice first that evolution is not a testable scientific hypothesis at all, but rather a philosophical paradigm preferred by some men to the paradigm of biblical creationism. Notice second in my lecture that, ironically, evolution does not end up defeating the notion of creative design which is taught in Scripture, but rather reintroduces that notion now in a metaphorical and immanentistic fashion. Darwin did not merely introduce a restricted biological hypothesis in his theory of evolution. What he introduced was, in fact, a thorough worldview, and the popularity of his ideas affected a cultural revolution in thought to a new basic paradigm of reality. That paradigm being the model of constant process and developmentalism. Darwin shifted attention, you see, away from the model of permanence in metaphysics to that of constant change and constant flux. The idea of transition was now going to be applied throughout life, so that now transition and development and evolution could even be applied to morals and to our philosophy of man. In that regard, I wish to quote some words of John Dewey for you. John Dewey, well known as an advocate of Darwinian evolutionism and its application to philosophy. Dewey says that the combination of the very words origin and species embodied an intellectual revolt and introduced a new intellectual temper is easily overlooked by the expert. The conceptions that had reigned in the philosophy of nature and knowledge for 2,000 years, the conceptions that had become the familiar furniture of the mind, rested on the assumption of the superiority of the fixed and the final. They rested upon treating change and origin as signs of defect and unreality. In laying hands upon the sacred ark of absolute permanency, in treating the forms that had been regarded as types of fixity and perfection as originating and passing away, the Origin of Species introduced a mode of thinking that in the end was bound to transform the logic of knowledge and hence the treatment of morals, politics, and religion. The sufficiency of immanent categories of interpretation. What am I talking about here? Immanent means close to us, nearby, part of our experience. It is in contrast to transcendent, that which is beyond man, beyond his experience, beyond his sensation, and all the rest. I'm saying the sufficiency of immanent categories of interpretation, which is just the philosophy of naturalism, was enunciated in Darwin's argument for evolution from the field of biology. But of course, such a theory as evolution was proposed many, many, many years ago, as early as Anaximander, the second great Western philosopher. Anaximander was an evolutionist. I mean, if that's all we're looking for, then we shouldn't be talking about Darwin tonight. Why, then, do we talk about Darwin? Why is 1859 such a turning point in intellectual history? What's so important about his work? Darwin's success over against Anaximander and all the others who were evolutionists throughout history, Darwin's success in advancing the evolutionary argument rested completely upon his proposal of a mechanism for natural evolution. He could tell us how it worked, and that was the mechanism of natural selection. The vast variety of species which exist or have existed have not been created in a special fashion by God, but have rather arisen over long eons of time by the operation of natural causes. And the machinery of this evolution was not the guiding hand of a creator, but rather natural selection. As Darwin said, in the struggle for existence, the fitter species will survive to propagate their kind and inevitably replace the less fit, thereby bringing it about that all of life tends to get better and better. The doctrine of the survival of the fittest made the Genesis story superfluous. Naturalism was now the philosophic victor. Facts had driven out traditional dogma. We don't need to consult Moses to find out where lions and tigers and horses come from now. And so it would seem, until serious philosophical attention is paid to the theory of evolution, and I mean serious philosophical attention. I'm not talking about armchair philosophy. I'm not talking about philosophers who want to dabble. I'm talking about getting down in the nitty-gritty and doing some logic and doing some analysis and looking at the argument. We must first note that evolution has a thoroughly speculative origin, being proposed first of all by philosophers, not scientists. You want to know why a philosopher is talking about evolution tonight? Because it's our theory as philosophers. It is not a scientific theory. It was first proposed by philosophers and not scientists. The philosophical climate of Darwin's day, if you read the philosophy of the 19th century, you're going to be amazed at what Darwin had done. It was little. He gave a mechanism, and for that he was famous. But the theory of evolution, the idea of development and an origin of things, was in the air. The philosophical climate of the day was characterized by a stress on anti-transcendence, on pantheistic monism, and the idea of dynamic process in all things, and materialism. The theory of evolution had its philosophical precursors. Philosophical precursors. You read Kant's view of the natural history of the world, or Spinoza, or Fichte. Look at Goethe, or Krauss, or Hegel, Feuerbach, Engels, Marx. Look at the French materialists, Diderot, Lemaître, de Holbach, and Buchner. All evolution. It's all there. Not greatly developed and outlined in detail. Not because they took a ride upon the Beagle and came back with scientific evidence. But that was all of them had that paradigm of reality. All of them had that philosophy of history and were advancing it. Indeed, that was pointed out very early. In his historical introduction to the book, Origin of Species, Darwin was indifferent to his precursors. And that is something for which he was sharply criticized in one of the earliest reviews of his book. In the 1860, Volume 3, edition of the Edinburgh Review, Richard Owen reviews his book and really takes him to task for taking credit for something which everybody else has been saying for a long time. Theory of evolution had its philosophical precursors, remember that. And it was encouraged, I think, more and more by the defection of theologians who, being committed to higher criticism of the Bible, were unwilling to defend the historical and scientific authority of Scripture. Darwin came only later. Darwin, you see, is a Johnny-come-lately when it comes to these matters. Moreover, the theory of evolution is not only speculative in its historical origin, it is basically anti-religious in its motivation. And I trust I've evidenced that enough from the previous statements from Darwin, Huxley, and others already. Now, you don't have to be anti-religious to be interested in the theory, but you can't deny that the early advocates of the theory were anti-religious men. That was their motivation. Furthermore, this theory, which was speculative in its origin and anti-religious in its motivation, has been and it continues to be held by men who recognize that it is contrary to the known facts or principles. I think that is it's when I came across evidence of that nature when I was a graduate student that it hit me like a ton of bricks. There's something very, very strange and philosophical going on here. Evolution is telling us we know the facts appear to be against us, but we need the theory anyway. This indicates that it is presuppositional in nature, I want to tell you. It's really a paradigm in terms of which the facts are now going to be interpreted. It is not a theory that is controlled by an examination of the facts. It is rather a theory used to explain the facts. It is a way of looking at the world. It is not something the facts tell us. It's something that helps us read the facts. It is, if you will, eyeglasses through which we look at the world. There has, in fact, come about a revolution in people's presuppositions with respect to the world. Evolution still cannot explain the mechanism. Evolutionists still cannot explain the mechanism of evolution. They cannot explain the taxonomic gaps of the fossil record. They cannot explain or avoid contradictions with known genetic principles, explain the appearance, or in light of entropy, the eternality of matter. They cannot explain the emergence of life, the emergence of self-conscious intelligence, and finally, the emergence of a moral consciousness. I hate to pass over each one of those things as worthy of a lecture. I mean, what are we to do with somebody who's supposed to explain human nature and history, who says, well, boy, we don't know how unsentient matter became sentient, or how sentient matter became intelligent, or how intelligent matter became moral? I mean, these are huge leaps philosophically, not to mention the huge gaps in the fossil record. These things are not explained. The modern evolutionist is just as gratuitous in his commitments as the evolutionist of last century. For example, Theodosius Dobzhansky claims to be able to explain evolution, quote, if the assumption is made that life arose from matter only once. He says, no, I realize that's rather hard to swallow, that matter gave rise to life. But he says, if you just grant the assumption once, then we got the ball rolling. Yeah, but you see, that's just the thing we won't grant. That's what we want to hear about. Dr. Thompson, the one who wrote the introduction to the current edition of The Origin of Species, writes, personal convictions are presented as if they were proofs. This is the man who's introducing the book. Scientists still recognize the inalienable flaws of the theory. For example, Paul Westermeyer declares, quote, and this is from an evolutionist, friends. He says, quote, evolution is useful, but it is a myth. The presuppositional status of the evolutionary theory is perhaps nowhere quite as obvious as it is in the writer Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. He says that even if all the specific content of the evolutionary explanation of life were to be demolished, evolution would still have to be taken as our fundamental vision. Defenders of evolution, quote, must never let themselves be deflected into secondary discussions of the scientific hows and the metaphysical whys. Secondary considerations, he says. Evolution has become the unassailable, the authoritative, the logically primitive, and I dare say religiously followed standard of truth for so many people today. Chardin says evolution has long since ceased to be a hypothesis and has become a general epistemological condition which must henceforth be satisfied by every hypothesis. It's become a presupposition. And he admits it. Instead of Jehovah's revelation, evolution will be the light in which men shall see. Indeed, he says, it is the light illuminating all facts, a curve that all lines must follow. W.T. Jones, in his History of Western Philosophy, has said, quote, and he is no Christian, no religious advocate, he says, quote, scientists have elevated Darwinism to the level of a religious dogma. And Thompson, the writer of the introduction to the new edition of The Origin of Species, concurs by saying that the concept of organic evolution was an object of genuinely religious devotion. I have one other quote here that I think is perhaps as fitting as any. From the 1943 April edition of the periodical 19th Century, D.M.S. Watson says, quote, evolution is accepted by zoologists not because it has been observed to occur or can be proved by logically coherent evidence to be true, but because the only alternative, special creation, is clearly incredible. Therefore, evolutionism, I dare say, was the spirit of Darwin's day. It swelled from process speculation in philosophy and anti-transcendent, anti-biblical attitudes in general culture. Darwin merely gave this philosophical presupposition a veneer of scientific respectability. Only a veneer, only a cosmetic, although his theory was immediately refuted by leading scientists of his day in terms of the science of that day. I'm not saying that their reputations would be the ones we would use today, but in that day, immediately he was attacked by leading scientists of his day. Still, men clung to it as a basic conviction in their lives. They clung to it as a religious faith. As always, the question of origins is one that pertains to a person's basic philosophical outlook. You should have expected this, because you can't test evolution in the laboratory. It's not the sort of thing that you can go out and perform experiments upon. Evolution is, in the very nature of the case, explanatory of something which we cannot see, and therefore at best can be a rational reconstruction of history. It cannot be an examination of history. And for that reason, it must be philosophical in character. Now, something further needs to be noticed about evolutionary philosophy. Having said that, I haven't said near enough. You think I'm worked up about this? I have something more to say. Not only did Darwin's theory give new expression to a common tendency to believe in progress and developmentalism as basic models of explanation, that is, he was putting a scientific veneer on basic paradigms or presuppositions that were already popular in his day, Darwin's theory, contrary to those initial appearances, gave no more than expression to such a philosophical model. I'm saying that the scientific veneer washes off very easily. In order to commend evolution to his readers, Darwin, as I told you, proposed the mechanism of natural selection. It was early thought that Darwin had discovered the operation of this mechanism in nature through an empirical study of facts. That is, it was thought that Darwin went out into the world and did his investigation, did his research, and lo and behold, look what I find out in the world, I find natural selection working. However, Darwin did not discover anything at all. If we use the idea of discovery in the ordinary sense, natural selection was not a discovery. It was an organizing idea. It was a model which occurred to Darwin by his own admission in reading a sociologist by the name of Malthus, and that long before his famous voyage on the Beagle. I'd like to say a little bit about his autobiography. In his autobiography, he says that the supposition he needed for explaining species or origination came when, and I quote, in October 1838, I happened to read for amusement Malthus on population. Now, for those of you who are not aware of this, T.R. Malthus wrote two important essays on the principles of population, wherein he expounded a supposed struggle for existence that promised population doom instead of the utopian vision that had been seen by some in his own day. Malthus was basically an alarmist who set forth a speculative thesis which, by myopic restriction of the factors that play upon population control, has been demonstrated to be false in terms of biology and history. Darwin says, however, that it hadn't been demonstrated in Darwin's day, but since Darwin's day, Malthus has been rejected. Darwin says that in reading Malthus, quote, it at once struck me that under these circumstances, favorable variations would tend to be preserved and unfavorable ones destroyed. The result of this would be new species. Here, then, I had a theory by which to work. I hope the lateness of the hour hasn't dulled you to what I just told you. This is devastatingly embarrassing. Here's a biologist who said, I didn't discover this theory. I read it 20 years before the fact in a sociologist who was speculating about the nature of population control. Significantly, A.R. Wallace, the co-discoverer of the theory of natural selection, had also come to this conclusion by reading Malthus as he states in his own autobiography entitled My Life. In The Origin of Species, Darwin said, quote, "It is the doctrine of Malthus applied with manifold force to the whole animal and vegetable kingdom." And thus it turns out that Darwin's biological insight stems from sociological guesswork. And I want to add, false guesswork at that. And so the theory of evolution with the idea of natural selection was not a discovery Darwin made. It was an organizing idea. It was a model which occurred to him when he read Malthus. In fact, Darwin applied the idea of selection, which he had observed as a process of animal breeders, to nature as a whole, as a matter of analogy. Okay, there's something else for your notes. What I'm saying is, Darwin saw the idea of selection being used in animal breeders. And that's true. There is a selection process. You breed for the best traits, or the traits that you consider best, the ones you want to see in the offspring of your cattle or your pigeons or whatever you may be breeding. Darwin had seen how individuals control the factors and try to breed for favored characteristics. And then he went on to say, well, this is what nature does. Anybody who studied any elementary logic knows exactly what's wrong with that argument. It's called false analogy. That's saying nature is like an animal breeder, right? And just like we have commercials these days that you shouldn't fool Mother Nature. But we all know there's no such thing as nature. Nature is what's called a reification, giving substantial existence to something that's only a generalization in our language. Nature stands for all those things that just happen to happen in the world. But Darwin said nature is like an animal breeder. Again, he began with a sociological hypothesis, not a biological one, and then applied it by way of false analogy from what he saw in the animal breeders of his day. Nature was viewed as selecting those organisms which were best suited to survive the struggle for existence, thus bringing about evolution and constant improvement in those surviving organisms. While in his country retreat, Darwin spent a good deal of time with pigeon fanciers, it turns out, and animal breeders. He even bred pigeons himself. The particular relevance to him was that breeders bred for certain characteristics, length of feather, length of wool, coloring, and all the rest, that the offspring of the selected mates often tended to have the desired characteristic more abundantly or more noticeably than its parents. And thus it could perhaps be said a small amount of evolution had occurred between one generation and another when you're doing animal breeding. By analogy, then, the same process occurred in nature, Darwin thought. As he wrote in The Origin of Species, quote, "How fleeting are the wishes of man, how short his time, and consequently how poor will his productions be compared with those accumulated by nature during whole geological periods. Can we wonder, then, that nature's productions should be far truer in character than man's productions?" And the answer is, well, yes, we should certainly wonder that something that doesn't even exist, Mother Nature, could do such a thing. It didn't even occur to him that he was talking philosophical nonsense here. He was talking just in the manner, we can talk about Mother Nature, but anybody who takes that seriously is not going to be considered a scientist in our day and age. Just as the breeders selected those individuals best suited to the breeders' needs to be the parents of the next generation, so Darwin argued nature selected those organisms that were best fitted to survive the struggle for existence. In that way, evolution would inevitably occur. And so, there it was, a sort of improving machine inevitably at work in nature, as he said, daily and hourly scrutinizing, silently and insensibly working at the improvement of each organic being. These are his words, not mine. He's the one who committed these fallacies. He's the one who reified and used metaphor and false analogy. In this way, Darwin thought one type of organism could be transformed into another. For instance, he suggested that bears could be turned into whales if you just applied these procedures. And you see, that's how we come to have horses and tigers and things, by natural selection. It's all so very easy. The great philosophical difficulty with all this. The philosophical difficulty with claiming that individuals that are best adapted to survive have a better opportunity to survive than those not so well adapted. It's simply the fact that this claim is true by definition. What Darwin proposed was not a hypothesis in biology that could be tested by prediction. It was rather a tautology. It was something that was but definitionally true. And that is the crucial problem with natural selection. The evolutionist may speak of the survival of the fittest, but he has no independent way of identifying the fittest other than looking at what? The survivors. And so he finds out which are the fittest by seeing which survived, and then concludes, lo and behold, it's the fittest who survived. He reasons in a very, very obvious circle. And so Darwin's theory was not even scientific in nature, providing for verifiable and falsifiable predictions. It was simply a vacuous truism. It was the statement of a definitional circle. T.H. Morgan, winner of the Nobel Prize for his work in mapping the chromosomes of fruit flies, suggested, I thought I'd better quote a scientist lest you think this is just some kind of raving philosopher up here. T.H. Morgan, internationally renowned scientist, has said, this whole theory looks suspiciously like a tautology. Quote, for it may appear little more than a truism to state that the individuals that are best adapted to survive have a better chance of surviving than those not so well adapted to survive. The philosophical debate of the past 10 to 15 years has focused precisely on this point. The survival of the fittest? Is there any way of identifying the fittest other than by looking at the survivors? The preservation of favored races? Any way of identifying them other than by looking at the preserved races? If not, then Darwin's theory is reduced from the status of a scientific theory to that of a tautology. Darwin, I'm saying, just assumed that there really were independent criteria of fitness. For instance, it appeared obvious to him that extra speed would be useful for a wolf in an environment where prey was scarce, and only those wolves first on the scene of a kill would get enough to eat and therefore survive. Seems obvious, doesn't it? If the wolf can run faster, he's fittest. And if he runs faster, he'll get to the prey first, he'll get his dinner, he won't starve to death, and so he'll survive. The survival of the fittest. And that just seemed obvious to Darwin, that we could say a faster wolf is a fitter wolf. The response to that, however, has been as follows from people who have studied the issue. A mutation that happens to enable a wolf to run faster than the pack in which he is in only enables the wolf to survive better if that wolf does, in fact, survive better. You may not automatically assume that a mutation making a wolf a faster runner is going to make him fitter. Such a mutation could also result in the wolf outrunning the pack a couple of times and getting the first crack at the food and then abruptly dropping dead of a heart attack. Because, you see, the extra power that the mutation brought to his legs only put an extra strain on his heart. Biological organisms, you see, are united things. You cannot assume that just because one element of the wolf has been improved, that that's going to make him fit for survival. It may just be his downfall. Well, then how do we know which it's going to be? Oh, and there's the rub. We have to wait and see. We have to see which wolves do survive, and then we'll know which were the fittest. But then we're right back to the problem. Survival of the fittest? Where we look at the ones who survive and say, well, then they must be the fittest. Fitness must be identified with survival because it is the overall animal that survives and not just part of the animal, like the faster legs. However, we don't have to worry too much about umpiring this particular dispute because a look at the biology books of our day will show us that evolutionary biologists themselves, perhaps in anticipation of this criticism, retreated to a fortified position some time ago, and they conceded the survival of the fittest doctrine as a truth and a tautology and made preparation to hold on to evolution in other ways. Here is C.H. Waddington, a prominent geneticist, speaking at the Darwin Centennial in Chicago, and I quote, natural selection, which was at first considered as though it were a hypothesis that was in need of experimental or observational confirmation, turns out on closer inspection to be a tautology, a statement of an inevitable, although previously unrecognized, relation. It states that the fittest individuals in a population, defined as those which leave the most offspring, will leave the most offspring. The admission that Darwin's theory of natural selection was tautological did not greatly bother the evolutionary theorists, however, because they'd already taken the precaution of redefining natural selection to mean something quite different from what Darwin had in mind. Like the philosophical debate of the past decade, remarkable development went largely unnoticed by men. In its new form, natural selection meant nothing more than that some organisms have more offspring than other organisms. That is, the view of differential reproduction. This, indeed, was an empirical fact about the world. I don't question that. Not just something true by definition, as was the case in the earlier claim about the survival of the fittest. The bold fact, however, of redefining selection was made by the British statistician and geneticist R.A. Fisher in a widely heralded book called The Genetical Theory of Natural Selection. Moreover, by making certain assumptions about birth and death rates and combining them with a Mendelian genetics, Fisher was able to qualify the resulting rates at which the population ratios changed. And this was called population genetics. And it brought great happiness to the hearts of many biologists because the mathematical formulae looked so deliciously scientific and seemed to enhance the status of biology, making it much more like physics. But here is what Waddington recently said about this development. Quote, "The theory of neo-Darwinianism is a theory of the evolution of the population in respect to leaving offspring and not in respect to anything else. Everybody has it in the back of his mind that the animals that leave the largest number of offspring are going to be those best adapted also for eating peculiar vegetation or something of this sort. But this is not explicit in the theory. There you do come to what is in effect a vacuous statement. Natural selection is that some things leave more offspring than others, and you ask, which leave more offspring than others? And it is those that leave more offspring, and there's nothing more to it than that. The whole real gut of evolution, which is how do you come to have horses and tigers and things, is outside the mathematical theory altogether." I remind you, I was quoting. End of quote. Here then we have the problem. Darwin's theory was supposed to answer the question about horses and tigers and elephants and things. How do we get all these different species? Well, they had gradually developed, bit by bit as it were, over the eons through the good offices of an agency called natural selection. But now, in its new incarnation, natural selection was only able to explain how horses and tigers became more or less numerous as horses and tigers. This failed to solve the question of how they came into existence in the first place. And of course, this is no good at all. As T.H. Morgan had remarked with great clarity, I quote, "Selection, then, has not produced anything new, but only more of certain kinds of individuals. Evolution, however, means producing new things, not more of what already exists." So let me recapitulate my philosophical analysis up to this point. By means of a false analogy from artificial breeding to natural patterns of descent, Darwin proposed the doctrine of natural selection, which appeared to give the philosophy of evolution scientific credentials. However, the survival of the fittest was merely an empty tautology which scientifically explained nothing at all. It was only true by definition. As such, Darwin's gift of hope to the advocates of evolution, an evolutionary model of the world, the proposed mechanism of natural selection was simply the reiteration of the popular doctrine of developmental progress. It was just one more expression of the philosophical perspective that was already in the wind of the 19th century. Darwin's victory for naturalism over against the traditional view of supernatural design in the world was simply Pyrrhic. Natural selection was supposed to have something of a creative role explaining the origin of species, in the place of the explanation given by Christians in the Bible. But Darwin had not discovered anything scientifically. It is a blind, automatic, impersonal force which operates according to natural selection, now redefined as differential reproduction. Continue to speak of it in terms of personal and teleological metaphors. If you read modern biologists and theorists in this regard, you'll notice how they compare differential reproduction to a composer, to a poet, to a playwright, to a builder, to a sculptor. We just don't seem to be able to get away from that idea of design and a designer, even if we're talking about Mother Nature instead of about the living and true God of heaven and earth. Impersonal naturalism of a full-blown variety, therefore, has not been confirmed, has not been advanced in the slightest by the legacy of Darwin. And I dare say any honest philosophical analysis must lead you to that conclusion. But now, what if somebody comes along and says, well, yes, but you've been dealing with impersonal naturalism. What about theistic evolution? What about the idea that there is a God in heaven who is directing all of this? And that's where we get the Mother Nature idea, the playwright, the sculptor, the author of all this going on. The theory of theistic evolution, I'm going to change hats here for a minute. I've been a philosopher for a moment. I'm not going to talk to you theologically before we stop for some questions. Theistic evolution teaches that man gradually, by slight degrees, evolved from lower animal forms over many years by a process which God providentially directed. Okay? You understand the idea? Man, over many years, gradually, degree by degree by degree, evolved from lower animal forms, and that by a process that was directed providentially by a personal God. All right? Let's start asking some obvious questions. Why would anybody propose and commit himself to such a theory? Why would anybody suggest that God did that sort of thing? You see, I have a particular theological commitment that God sent his Son into the world knowing that his Son would go to the cross. And I admit that prima facie, that looks rather strange. Why would God do such a thing? And the Christian has an answer for that, for the sake of saving men. Okay, and we're not going to get into that. This is not my opportunity to preach to you tonight. But when somebody says God does the following, it's natural to ask, why would he do that sort of thing? Now somebody's saying, here's what God did. He providentially guided a process of gradual evolution over many years so that man came forth from lower animal forms. And I ask, well, why would we propose that? Why would anybody suggest that? Why would anybody be committed to such a theory? Especially noting, first of all, the hostile intention and the prejudice of the earliest and most recent advocates of evolution. Where would any religious man get the idea that evolutionists are trying to shoulder up with us and walk side by side down the intellectual path? I mean, look at what they thought they were up to. I mean, they're not the sort of people a religious man's going to go and embrace and say, thank you so much for that theory. That's what we're looking for. I mean, the hostile intent of evolutionists has got to be taken into account. However, even those who are less vocal in repudiating the Bible, those who are not really evolutionists because they want to shake the fist at God, even those who are less vocal in repudiating the Bible still hold at least these two premises, that biological research must be religiously neutral and that there is a rigid uniformity of natural law that has to be respected. Biological research is religiously neutral and there's a rigid uniformity of natural law. But you see, the Bible says that God directly and continuously intervenes in nature so that his power and his divinity, to use the words of Paul, are clearly seen in the natural world. God is not some kind of absentee God who refuses to intervene so that there's this rigid uniformitarianism to be seen in natural law. Moreover, because he is clearly seen, biological research can't be religiously neutral, because every time you study the world, you're going to confront your maker. Well, that's what the Bible says. Now, it may be that it's not true. I happen to think it's true and important. But if it's true, if people believe that that's what the Bible says, why would they, as Bible believers, go to an evolutionist who must at least say there's rigid uniformity and biological research is neutral? I mean, it just strikes me as so incongruous. I can't figure out any good reason for a religious person to want to believe in theistic evolution. Well, here's a reason. It just dawned on me. Somebody says, well, we have to adjust to modern scientific truth, don't we? I mean, we can't be obscurantists. We can't be people who have their heads in the ground. We can't advance anachronistic theories, religious speculation, and expect these intelligent scientists to find out otherwise, and then we don't make adjustments. You're not asking that of us, are you? So the person says, here's why I believe in theistic evolution, because I want to be up with the times. I want to bring my religion and my science together and harmonize them. That sounds good on the surface. But do you really want to adjust yourself to modern scientific truths when I remind you that modern scientific truth is constantly changing? People who say that, I usually ask them, how many books on the philosophy of science have you read lately? The philosophy of science is an absolute zoo today, with people proposing this and then people proposing that. It's just a chaos of theories. As Thomas Kuhn has spoken of, there is this structure of scientific revolutions. And these revolutions take place. Are you saying that every time a scientific revolution takes place, we Christians have now got to line up with the new revolutionists? So that now we're over here, and then when science changes, we go over here, and when science changes, we go over here? If that's the reason why we want to be theistic evolutionists, we're going to be hopscotching all day long. We can't keep up with modern science in that way. Science is constantly changing, being corrected, even going through evolutions. And I dare say, revolutions, and even if Freudian slip. I dare say that we're going to be as fickle as can be, scientifically, not just religiously, as fickle as can be if we're going to try to keep up with modern science. But more than that, I want to say also that the Bible does not wait to be interpreted by some autonomous science. The Bible does not allow us that option. I read a quote from Robert L. Dabney's words in his lectures in systematic theology. He's writing back in the days when Darwinism was really on the rise. He says, other pretended theologians have been seen advancing and then as easily retracting novel schemes of exegesis to suit new geologic hypotheses. Oh, that's embarrassing. Let me adjust my exegesis to fit in, and then all of a sudden science changes. Oh, well, wait a minute. I've got a different exegesis now. Dabney says these people have been doing this, and he says, the Bible has often had cause here to cry, save me from my friends. As remarked in a previous lecture, unless the Bible has its own ascertainable and certain law of exposition, it cannot be a rule of faith. Our religion is then but rationalism. I repeat, if any part of the Bible must wait to have its real meaning imposed upon it by another, a human science, then part is at least meaningless and worthless to our souls. I must expound it independently, making other sciences ancillary and not dominant over it. That's a great line. Save me from my friends. People who are theistic evolutionists, who are motivated in a noble sense to try to keep science and religion together, only end up doing injustice to science and religion, both. Well, then the only adequate reason to hold to theistic evolution, as I can see it, the only adequate reason is because the Bible teaches it. I mean, you wouldn't want to... I mean, there's no natural inclination to hold to theistic evolution when you notice that the evolutionists are overall pretty religiously hostile. And so then somebody says, well, but I have to adjust to modern science, and you've seen why we don't have to adjust to modern science. So what reason is left? The only reason I can see for theistic evolution is that man's evolution is taught in the pages of the Scripture. And I don't think man's evolution is taught in the pages of the Scripture. Now you're expecting maybe what I'm going to do is go to Genesis 1 and read for you and say, now I take a literal approach to the Bible and that settles the issue. Well, no, I'm going to leave it an open question how you interpret Genesis 1, whether you have a day-age theory, whether you have some kind of framework hypothesis for it, whether any number of theories. I don't happen to like all these other ones. I think the traditional approach to Genesis 1 is just fine. In fact, if it weren't for the threat of modern science, I don't think anybody would have been motivated to change their views of it. But put that aside. For good and sufficient theological and exegetical reasons, we cannot hold to theistic evolution. And I want to give you three reasons why. First of all, because man's origin is taught to be distinctive from the animals in the Bible. Man's origin may not be seen as analogous to or likened to the way animals came about. So even if you believe the animals were evolving, you must say, biblically, that man's origin is distinctive. For you see, when the Bible speaks of man's origin, there was a special engagement of the triune divine counsel. Man was created not by fiat, according to Genesis, but with the words, let us make man. Let us. God didn't take, you see, and have the divine counsel engage in the creation of a tiger. Let us make tigers. No, it's rather, let us make man in our own image. And thus it was a special event, something that could not be said, was not said, of the other acts of creation. Moreover, all other animals were created according to a created pattern. All the other animals were created, as Genesis says, after their kind. But when it gets to the creation of man, the Bible doesn't use that expression. It rather says man was created as the image of God. In the same place where animals are said to be created after their kind, God says, and man was created in the image of God. What's the implication? After the kind of God, who, of course, didn't evolve, even if you believe the animals did. And so man not only has a special event at his creation, the engagement of the divine counsel, but man is created with a special nature, a unique nature, made in the image of God. Moreover, there was a unique procedure used of no other animal, plant, or what have you. Does the Bible say that God, from the dust of the ground, formed it and then breathed into it spirit of life? All other forms of natural living being were brought forth with God saying, let the ground bring forth. But God rather now comes and forms from the dust man and then makes him a living soul. That in-breathing procedure is not true of any other of the aspects of creation. And so my first point is that man's origin is presented as a distinctive thing, distinctive from the animals. No other case do you find an engagement of the triune counsel of God. In no other case do you have this unique nature in the image of God rather than after its kind. In no other case the divine in-breathing. Secondly, man is distinct from the animals. Not just does he have a distinctive origin, but he is himself distinct from the animals. As I've said, he's made in the image of God, and that's why the Bible teaches that man's life has a peculiarly sacred character. When man is killed, there must be judicial retribution. That's not true of animals. Only for the blood of man being shed is there capital punishment, and that because God made him in his own image. Man is distinct from the animals. And moreover, no animal was found to be a suitable counterpart to man. In fact, man names the animals, and God doesn't bring the missing link between the ape and Adam to him and say, how about this for a wife? And Adam says, well, close enough. No, all the animals come before Adam, and God says, and Adam recognizes, nothing is appropriate because there's a gulf between man and the animal kingdom that cannot be spanned. Not even by degrees. There's an enormous chasm there, not a small degree between man and animals. As the psalmist says, man is but just a little lower than divinity. Not a degree above the apes, just but a degree below God, the image of God. Devastating, devastating theological consequences to all of that. In fact, so devastating when you study it, it's hard to believe that God would do that and think of us in that way, but he does. Well, there's one and last, the third reason why we can't hold the theistic evolution, and it's because the argument that's often given from the Bible for theistic evolution is utterly unacceptable exegetically. Somebody says, now wait a minute, look at the Bible. Doesn't it say God formed man from the dust of the ground? There you have it. Certainly it's poetic, metaphorical, that's all right. I mean, we can't a priori say that's impossible in the Bible. There's plenty of poetry and metaphor in the Bible. It says God formed man from the dust of the ground. And so isn't that just a way of saying that God took this natural world and let the dust develop, and he was using his creative powers, his providential powers, to form it and let it develop until it became a man? That is to say, this theory maintains that God making man out of the dust of the ground means God made man out of animal progenitors. Dust here refers to animal progenitors, to man, as well as other things, but dust all the way up through the animal kingdom, finally man. Well, there's some problems with this, and I'll be very brief. First, remember the divine impartation to this dust of life? The Bible says God formed the dust and then made it living. You cannot hold, therefore, if you're going to be true to the context, you cannot hold that this dust is living dust. It's lifeless dust until God breathes into it. And so animal progenitors, I think, exegetically impossible. Moreover, look at the context. Genesis 3:14 uses the same Hebrew word when it says the serpent was squiggling around in what? The dust. Now, are we to take that to mean the serpent was squiggling around in the animal kingdom? No, we would take it in the natural sense of dust on the ground. But then there's one final consideration. Genesis 3:19 says, from dust you came. There you have it, evolution, right? Theistic evolution. God forms man from the dust of the ground. From dust you came. until you read the second half of the verse, which says, "And to dust you shall return." If you believe in theistic evolution on the basis of this verse, you're consistently required to believe that man does not, in fact, die at all. He devolves. From dust you came means evolution. Then when man dies, as a matter of fact, what you see is the man turns into a monkey, and then turns into this and this, and this, finally a fish, and then an amoeba, and down into the slime. I realize that is humorous. But it's only humorous because people have sadly, for so longly, labored under the tyranny that says God's word must be subjected to the autonomous theories of a scientist. And whenever that happens, my friends, I dare say we are always going to be sent on a fool's errand, running about as fools to do something which God never intended us to do. No, evolution is not a biological hypothesis. It is a philosophical paradigm. And it's a philosophical paradigm that has not been given evidence, empirical support. In fact, many people know that the facts are very difficult to harmonize with the theory and yet say they must keep it. Natural selection is what was supposed to make Darwin famous. Natural selection was but a tautology. And as a matter of fact, Darwin has been quietly, secretly consigned to oblivion in modern biology. And as far as theistic evolution is concerned, I can't see any good reason to hold it unless it's taught in the Bible. And if anything's clear, it's that the Bible doesn't teach theistic evolution. Thank you.
Entertain a few questions.
Yes, sir.
What about all the dinosaurs?
Well, God made the dinosaurs too, so it doesn't surprise me that we found some dinosaur bones. But why don't you elaborate on your question a little bit? After man? Well, I think that the creation account gives us the order in which God made things. I mean, that's my own personal exegesis of Genesis, the first chapter. But if somebody were to, let's say that I hold that view and somebody suggests, but as a matter of fact, we can find remains of dinosaurs coming after men. So there's a conflict between the Bible and science. Well, I'd point out, first of all, there's a terrible logical mistake here. If somebody says, the earliest known find of a human skull or what have you is such and such a date, and the earliest known dinosaur thing is such and such a date, which is much later than that, all that shows is that we only have evidence of men and dinosaurs at those times. That doesn't prove that there weren't men or dinosaurs in the different ages. It just means we don't happen to have evidence of it. What if we were, you know, doing an archaeological dig of the city of New York 200 years from now? Somebody comes across a desk file that has certain clippings from the New York Times. And then the man said, well, I find an article here about JFK being assassinated, and I find an article here about Nixon having to resign from the presidency. I don't find any article that says that Ronald Reagan was president. He obviously wasn't ever president. That doesn't prove anything, does it? It only proves how much evidence we have. And so when archaeologists tell us things about dinosaurs and men, keep that in mind. Secondly, when archaeologists talk to us about their finds, we must keep them honest. When they want to date their finds, they must not be allowed to date their finds according to a preconceived theory. Okay? If you get down to a certain level in an archaeological dig, and you happen to find dinosaur bones, and then you dig a little bit further and you get human bones, or vice versa, I don't care how you construe the illustration, then the natural question is, well, which came first? Well, you have to date the layers, don't you? Well, how do you date the layers? Well, the common practice today is to date the layers by what you find in them. Since we find dinosaurs in this layer, we know that this layer is later, even though it may be higher than the one found below. Okay? And then after we've dated the layers, and then people come in, they file in for our little tour of the museum, and the museum curator says, now, we have interesting archaeological substantiation of evolution here, because here we have dinosaurs at this age and men at this age. It's also nice and neat, and it's also been built right into the evidence, because you dated it by your theory and then went back and said, look, we got evidence for our theory finally. No, I don't buy this archaeological stuff. In fact, I can be humorous and lighthearted about it, but in an academic setting, it is downright deplorable that more people are not kept honest in the way they argue. That kind of argumentation doesn't prove anything. It proves that a man's committed to a theory, and that's all. It doesn't prove anything about the theory and its worth. Other questions? Yes.
From what you presented tonight, it sounds like no Christian possibly would want to hold this theory, because the Bible, as we've argued, obviously doesn't hold it. Scientific evidence doesn't support it, and yet there are conservatively thousands of Bible-believing Christians who take some sort of, say, threshold evolution. They would say that it would say the point of animal evolution, God doesn't step in now as specialized creation and so forth and so on. What is your explanation as to why they would hold, what compels them to hold that? Are they so blind that scientific orthodoxy is pushing them in this direction, or what would you say?
Philosophers are always, of course, having to explain how it is people make mistakes, especially widespread mistakes. Why is it so many people believe in flying saucers? I guess there must be real flying saucers. Or can 10,000 Americans conceivably be wrong? Well, I know that's not the thrust of the questioner here, but we must guard ourselves against the idea that even an obvious mistake cannot be almost universally believed. I mean, why is it that people thought that the Earth was the center of the universe? Or that it was flat? Or any number of other really ridiculous things once believed about the nature of fire and breath and all the rest. I mean, I could go on and on. Well, the reason people do is because they've been conditioned, usually. They have presuppositions they often don't recognize. And then finally, I have to add this, and I do it, I hope, in due humility, that a lot of people just don't do their homework. They just don't really read enough. They hear a few things, maybe a respected professor or writer says something, and they figure, well, he knows good enough, he wouldn't mislead me, and so they follow it. I think if everybody were to go back and just re-examine for themselves these things, and of course you have to be able to read Hebrew to do some of this, and it helps to have a good course in logic while you're at college. Get that. I think the problem is people just make mistakes, and they are motivated to make those mistakes, or better, they are motivated, conditioned not to see those mistakes, because it's such a prevailing view these days. And I think that's really why. I don't think it's maliciousness. I don't think it's utter incompetence. I think it's, in many cases, just laziness, taking the shortcut, and not doing your homework. Or just being culturally captive. I really do feel badly that so many Christians hold to theistic evolution. That's why I present this lecture. So I'm trying to get them to at least go home and rethink the issue. Yes.
Study Parsons Bible now, and have two presuppositional frameworks, creationism, as you've offered for, and evolution, and that you get two capable men to adopt both of those frameworks, one adopting the evolution framework, one adopting the creation framework. They're both capable with a good mind, so to speak, that they could both make good sense of their frameworks, almost, in fact, equal sense. Or would you say that in the framework you think is best, the creation framework, if a man does a good job, he'll be able to show that the evidence fits best in the framework. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
The way to say it is, if a man puts on evolution glasses, he sees beautiful evidence for evolution.
Right, right.
If he puts on creation glasses, it's just as beautiful.
I don't know whether to rejoice or be in despair that I can't take another hour to talk about that. That is a crucial issue. In fact, it's one that's central to Christian apologetics. Why is it that when everybody looks at the evidence, they come up with different conclusions? What is the effect of presuppositions on the evidence? Does the evidence ever change our presuppositions? That sort of thing. So, I mean, you're asking a general question, which is really, really important. I hope all of you will think about that as well. Maybe I can lecture to you another day on that sort of subject if you're interested. But in answer to this question, in theory, people holding consistently to their presuppositions ought never to be pressed by the facts to give them up. The evolutionist can always say, when the creationist brings up some counter-evidence, we're working on that. Okay? And we're going to make it fit. It's an anomaly at the time being. And if the evolutionist brings up something to a creationist who hasn't done enough research and all that, and he's embarrassed, what's he going to say if he really has that presupposition? Well, everything else favors this, and you've got me on the run there, but I'm going to go home and study it some more. So if consistently, if men held their presuppositions consistently, perfectly, and logically, the evidence wouldn't budge them, wouldn't have to budge them. Now, what's the fact of the matter? I'm talking about people like their computers now, but they aren't. People are inconsistent. They're uneducated sometimes. Sometimes they have blind spots that are revealed. And as a matter of fact, you do find some Christians switching over under the burden of what appears to be a good case because they aren't seeing their Christian world and life view clearly enough. We have some evolutionists who aren't consistent enough who, when you start hitting at those cracks in the theory, finally give it up. So there is persuasion back and forth. In theory, there wouldn't have to be. Now, one last comment. Thirdly, I would say, in the present state of affairs, if we could get behind, let's say we could get a good Christian, hopefully humble but intelligent and willing to stay up all night long behind closed doors with another evolutionist like this and say, okay, now we're not going to let you go. None of this, you give your evidence for 10 minutes, I give mine for 10, and then we just, you know, like ships in the dark. But one point and one point, and we don't give up until that point settled. Now another point, not until that one settled. I dare say that in this day and age, the creationists would have the day. Because there are so many problems with the theory of evolution from the scientific standpoint that they keep shuffling off as just anomalies and so forth. The people doing the work at creation research centers, I think, have a lot to be said. However, a good evolutionist, one philosophically inclined and logically trained, would be able to handle that. But I still think there are cracks. Yeah.
Sir, you have given the implication in your talk that biologists are unconsciously, if not consciously, dishonest. If this is so, how come...
Well, you don't have to go any further. I don't hold that premise, so you don't have to develop it.
But let's put it this way. Well, let me put it in a less specific way and say that biologists are inclined to hold that. Biologists are, as a group, anti-religious. Now, you did sort of imply that. As a group, not all. And that they are inclined to hold on to a theory which favors their philosophical, shall we say, approach.
Right.
How would you then explain the change in astronomy and physics on the theory about the origin of the universe? The so-called move towards the Big Bang theory, which quite frankly bothers a great many astronomers because of its religious implications.
Let me say first that my inference about biologists holding on to their preconceived theoretical foundations despite the evidence is true. I believe that of biologists, but I believe it of all men. I am to think that's a universal intellectual trait of mankind. That's from my epistemological studies. I think that's part of the presuppositional nature of reasoning. People tend to hold on to their paradigms and give them up only at the greatest pain. Okay, so what I was saying about biologists was not uniquely true of biologists, true of all men. But now you're asking, why is it that biologists have been bothered by the religious implications of the Big Bang theory or gradually expanding universe?
Why is it in spite of the fact the astronomers were bothered by it, they reluctantly come to accept it because the scientific evidence seems
overwhelming. Yeah, the answer to that question is to be found in Thomas Kuhn's book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. In all honesty, the best thing I can do is give you a bibliography at that point. Because there has been a revolution for those scientists who have changed their mind, a revolution in the basic paradigm by which they're going to operate and do their natural science. There are, from time to time, changes in the outlook and model that are used. And the way that comes about, well, there's no general way to put it, but Kuhn talks about many of the factors. He's one of the most respected philosophers of science in our land today. I really commend that book to you. I think we probably would have done.
Thank you, Dr. Bond.
You're welcome.